Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight you to someone who's been on the Solari Report before, Alan Phillips, an attorney from North Carolina who has written the definitive book on vaccines exemptions and is the leading attorney in this country on vaccine exemptions, has a national practice for helping people with federal law. We'll talk more about that with Alan. Alan joined us on the Solari Report in 2009 when I was exceptionally concerned about helping our subscribers assert their religious or other exemptions to efforts to mandate the swine flu vaccine, which I was concerned was very dangerous. And we saw a real effort at that time to try and change state laws to simply mandate the swine flu vaccination. There was a tremendous groundswell against the swine flu vaccination, and that literally stopped it dead in its tracks, I think, in no small part thanks to the healthcare workers who many of whom said, I'm not going to take the vaccination and I'm not going to give the vaccination. Now, what happened, and in response to this wonderful question from one of our subscribers, what happened is we saw the same thing happen on vaccinations that we saw we're watching on the push for quote-unquote gun control, which is a real pushback from people knowledgeable about the topic and a conversion of an effort to mandate to a conversion to sell, sell, sell. And what you've seen since then is a tremendous effort to market and push and regulate for more vaccinations. And it was one of the reasons that I very much was appreciative that Alan could come back and join us this evening, because we've seen a really broad effort, not just to encourage, but to use regulation and workplace rule to force greater vaccination. And so for those of us who are insistent that we're not going to be vaccinated, or we're not going to allow our children to be vaccinated or over vaccinated, whatever your policies are, it's very, very important that you understand what your rights are and you know how to exercise exemptions. And if you're having any difficulty doing so, to know how to get expert help to do it. And so with no more introduction, Alan, are you with us? Well, thank you very much for joining us. I know how busy you are. And speaking of how busy you are, I would like to start this evening by you explaining to our listeners tonight, many of whom were not with us in 2009, how it was that you became so interested in vaccines and literally went from being an attorney in private practice dealing with business and other matters to somebody who's now the leading expert on vaccine exemption.
Well, actually, Catherine, my professional background is in music and technical writing. If you would have told me as a young adult that one day I would be an attorney or I'd be involved in legislative activism, I probably would have been on the ground laughing. No, seriously, it was the farthest thing from my mind. When my now 19-year-old son was born, a friend of mine told me that another friend of hers had a child who had been permanently disabled by a vaccine. I had never heard of such a thing. And so I went to the library and I found a wonderful book. I still think it's one of the best books to start with for people new to the issue, by Neil Miller, called Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? And it's short. You can read it in maybe half an hour, but it's just meticulously referenced, mostly to published medical studies, and it really was an eye-opener for me. And I was in such shock. It was literally about 6 months before I could open my mouth and talk to anybody about it, and it's been difficult to find people to talk about outside my practice anyway ever since, although I have slowly but steadily gotten a little more emboldened, and I just go ahead and put it out there and tell people what I do. But anyway, I'm a so-called second career attorney, or maybe 32nd, depending on how you count. But I was moved to go to law school because of the vaccine issue, and I was for many years, I've been practicing law about 10 years now, and for a large part of that time I was building the exemption and waiver part of my practice and doing other family law and general practice matters, but I'm exclusively focused now on vaccine exemptions and waivers, and I do a lot of legislative activism, helping people with the more technical legal aspects of vaccine legislative issues. So that's really how I got into it, and I have just really never turned back since first looking into it. And again, I've been looking into the issue. It's an ongoing research project as a parent and citizen, and I find that really the quickest and simplest way I can summarize what I have found and keep finding over the years on the issue, just generally the larger vaccine controversy, is the deeper I dig, the messier it gets. But that's kind of it. And when I started working with exemptions and waivers, I was quite naive, it turns out, about what that really encompassed. Again, it sort of depends on how you count, but I've discovered and worked with people in well over a dozen different exemption and waiver contexts or subcontexts. For me, anytime different law is involved, I consider it a separate category. So by that definition, there's, I don't know, 12, 15 or more different areas. We're all familiar with schools, for example, and school vaccine requirements and exemption issues, but there are many subcategories there. There's public schools, private schools, homeschooling, military schools, colleges, a whole separate issue that comes up with nursing and med students, EMT students, when they have to do clinical rotations in local hospitals. The state exemption laws don't apply to the hospitals, and so there's different law involved there. So all of these different areas, immigration, foreign adoption is a subset of that. Military, there's military members, families, military contractors, can be different law involved in each of those different situations and even with different branches of the military. One area that's been emerging increasingly over recent years for me is what I refer to as vaccine custody disputes, the typical cases where parents agree not to vaccinate until they split up or get divorced, and one parent, usually the dad, not always, but usually it's dad who decides he's going to go pro-vaccine and try to make mom look like a fruitcake and grab custody. And there are unique legal issues in those matters that family law attorneys generally don't come up with or know about, because you have to approach it differently than other custody matters. So just it's just a topic. And then a huge one that I've been working with a lot in recent months then healthcare workers, or you could generalize that to employees for hospitals around the country. And most of the time this has not been about state laws. It's just hospital policy where they mandate flu vaccines for the healthcare workers, or as a condition of employment, get the flu shot or lose your job. And
Let me jump back, because when you and I spoke in 2009, when you joined us on the Solari Report, it's fair to say that from that time on, when the effort to sort of mandate the swine flu failed, my impression is there has been a sort of a wave of what I describe as trench warfare, an effort on a much more granular level to institute, whether it's rules in schools or rules in hospitals, rules in the military, to really, and also more state laws to push to get vaccination much more implemented. So with the backlash from the swine flu, there's really been a sort of new wave of trench warfare in this area. Is that a fair description?
I have seen a very aggressive, let's just say push for vaccines on multiple levels, and I've been particularly aware of this since around the time of the pandemic and since then. And I'm not sure very many people I think there's a lot of people who are aware of, you know, one or more parts of this, but I don't think there's very many people really looking at kind of the overview, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were aspects to this that I'm not aware of either. But there's language in Obamacare, for example, that gives grants, federal grants to states to push vaccines, including things all the way to the level of going door to door, checking vaccine status or offering vaccines. The Department of Health and Human Services has an initiative called Healthy People 2020. Among their goals are vaccinating 90% of healthcare workers, but also vaccinating all employees in the U.S., not just healthcare workers. There's been a wave of changes in pediatric practice where pediatricians initially were increasingly using an American Academy of Pediatrics form called a refusal to vaccinate form, where they're requiring parents to sign a form that effectively says what a bad person you are for not vaccinating if their children are unvaccinated before they would treat the children, putting parents in a really awkward place because they're being told to sign something they disagree with if they want their child to be treated. They've gone a step further than that. Now I'm hearing from people around the country saying that pediatricians are just flat out refusing to see any unvaccinated child.
Right. There have been many reports about that this year.
Yeah. I mean, increasingly over the last several months. If the even a pediatrician in private practice, if they accept Medicaid and Medicare, is probably violating the parents' constitutional rights if the parents have a religious exemption. But just sort of flat out, whatever reason, if you're not vaccinated, you can't bring your kid here, raises some ethical and legal issues. There have been a rash of new laws passed around the country, and particularly the last couple of years, and there are pending bills in other states to restrict access to exemptions, in particular for school exemptions, kids in school. And some of these laws, in my opinion, are unconstitutional. But just as to clarify that, a law technically is not unconstitutional until a court says so. So state legislatures or the federal legislature, for that matter, can pass any law they get the votes for and have the governor sign or the president sign or whatever the procedure is, ultimately, whether it's constitutional or not, because until someone later challenges it in court, it is technically deemed to be constitutional. So when I say unconstitutional, what I mean is I don't think they would hold up to a challenge in court.
Right. Now, what stunned me today was your description of several state laws which have basically taken the power away from the parents so that now a child, including a very young child, can consent without the parents' knowledge or permission. Maybe you could just describe that as well.
Sure. The most egregious example, I'm embarrassed to say, is right here in my own state of North Carolina. I stumbled on the existence of this law several months ago when one of the local school districts had a contest where they were giving away an iPad and a laptop computer for adolescents who would go out and get one or more of the three recommended vaccines. They weren't required by state law, DTaP, meningitis, and HPV vaccines. And discover that there's a law here in North Carolina that allows a child of any age, the very first two words of the law are the words any minor, to consent to vaccines and other medical treatment without the parents' knowledge and consent. And try to make a longer story short, that's just blatantly unconstitutional. Parents in the United States have a constitutional right and obligation to parent their children, and there's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says children cannot make medical decisions for themselves, that parents have to make those decisions, even older children. If they're still minors, parents have the authority and have the obligation to make those decisions. Now, obviously, there could be specific instances where a parent is adjudicated to be unfit, and then, of course, some other adult has to make decisions for that child. But the state cannot cannot constitutionally take parental authority away from all parents in the state and give it to anybody else, not even another adult, let alone children who by legal and medical definitions both are not competent to make those decisions. This is very disturbing when that kind of law is on the books. There's just
now one of these states is California. Is that correct?
Yes, they have a law that passed, I think, January 1st a year ago, or that took effect January a year ago, allowing 12-year-olds and up to consent to the HPV vaccine without parental knowledge and consent.
So if I live in California and I have a child who's 12 to 18, I better be aware of this and be prepared to educate my child to not consent if that's what is desired.
I think so. And I was reading about a court case recently where it was during the pandemic in 2009, I think, where they were giving the swine flu shots at school, and the parent had a form saying that she did not give consent. And for some reason, I'm sure just a mistake on somebody's part, the child ended up getting vaccinated anyway. I've heard other people suggest very common sense advice that if you know vaccines are being administered at your child's school and you don't want your child vaccinated, just keep your child home that day. That's the only way to really ensure that
right.
There are no mistakes. But it's particularly disturbing when a child of any age can do that, because how can you educate, you know, a second grader to say no to vaccines or to even put a child in the position of having to, you know, deal with that.
To say, right, they shouldn't even be in that position. Well, let's turn to exemptions and how we can learn to exercise our exemptions. And two of the areas I'd like to focus on, because as you said, there are 12 different categories with subcategories. And before we continue, I just want to point out that you have an excellent book, I have it, on vaccine exemptions. And it really is the definitive work in the area, and you can access it at your website, which we'll give it out at the end, and we link to it on the blog. So if this is an area where you're going to need to be exercising exemptions, this is absolutely sort of the definitive work in the area, and I would encourage you to get that book. But let's just focus on schools and healthcare workers. And maybe hospitals. And let's start with schools, Alan. If I have a child in school, and let's just assume public schools here, and whether it's state law or the school practice, they are requiring vaccinations, and I don't want my child to have a vaccination, what are my rights? What can I do?
Well, the first step is to see what the exemption laws in your state are, because the laws vary from state to state. The federal government, at least theoretically, does not have the authority to mandate vaccines for state residents, and that's why the laws are all at the state level for school enrollment, vaccine requirements, and the exemptions as well. And the wording of the law and the exemption options are just going to vary from state to state. But generally, there are three different types of exemptions. Medical exemptions, every state has medical. Religious exemptions, 48 states have one form or another of religious exemption, all but Mississippi and West Virginia. And then philosophical exemptions, and about 20 or so states have an exemption where you just don't have to explain yourself, give some sort of medical religious explanation. You just, in effect, say no, thank you. Most of those are west of the Mississippi. There's maybe about three states in the east of the Mississippi that offer a philosophical exemption. But again, the procedure, the specific procedure is going to vary state to state. Some states have a form, some don't. Some with a religious exemption, you have to spell out your beliefs, and others you don't. You really just have to look at each state individually, the laws. I want to comment, if I may, on this, because you mentioned that you have a lot of listeners in California, and Oregon is looking at passing a law that looks like it would resemble what California has now, in that the law doesn't mention the word religion or religious, and a lot of people, I think, misinterpret that to mean that there's no religious exemption there. You have to look at the language, and there's a legal principle that is generally applicable, I suspect, in all states that, in effect, amounts to if a law is unambiguous, if it's clear by its plain language, English language meaning, it means exactly what it says, nothing more, nothing less. So if you have an option for an exemption and you don't have to explain the reason. You know, in California, I think they use the phrase personal beliefs. That would certainly encompass any personal belief, whether it's religious or not. So people can still refuse. And it's my understanding the California Department of Health has confirmed this, and that's not just my personal opinion on that. But you have to look and see what the procedure is. Now, I have on my website, I have a page where I list links for every state to three other websites that post the state exemption laws. And the laws do change from time to time, but I think these are fairly reliable sources. And probably every state, or just about every state at this point in time, has a website where people, the general public, can go to search statutes and regulations. But I do encourage people, when you're looking at the law, to look at statutes and health department regulations, because sometimes the entire law and procedure will be just in the statutes. But I think probably more often than not, you really need to look at a combination of exemption statutes and health department regulations to get the whole story. What are the exemption options? What is the correct procedure? And the place to be particularly concerned is any situation where, with religious exemptions, that you have to state your beliefs. Because on the one hand, Catherine, what even with state exemption laws, what determines what does and doesn't qualify for a religious exemption ultimately is the First Amendment of the Constitution. And under the First Amendment, just about anybody who's not an atheist could potentially qualify for a vaccine religious exemption. And under federal civil rights law that applies to employees, there's even language that encompasses a narrow category of beliefs you could hold as an atheist that are protected religious beliefs. So in terms of who can qualify as a general starting point, for the most part, it's really broad. Now, there's a few states that still have antiquated laws that require you to be a member of an organized religion, and that's a little more complicated. Those are unconstitutional laws and arguably unenforceable as to the organized membership requirement. So there are ways you can deal with that issue. But as a general rule, it's really broad. Where it gets tricky, though, is with regard to what specific beliefs do and don't qualify. And in my experience, most people who approach this on their own, if they're in a situation where their beliefs are going to be scrutinized, and that is a separate question that can vary from state to state or context to context, most people will include things that can complicate or even undermine the right. It's just the way the law works in this area, it's a little bit tricky. Let me give you one classic example, because I kind of hate to say that as a general concept and just leave it floating out there. Many people, when they write a statement of their religious beliefs that are opposed to vaccines, want to bring in a discussion about vaccine safety or vaccine effectiveness. And when those kinds of issues are addressed in a situation where the beliefs get scrutinized, they almost always get rejected, because those are issues that are considered to be medical or scientific issues and not religious, for one thing. And for another thing, as a legal technicality, you can argue, and I do, that vaccines legally are safe and effective. They would not have been, there's a legal presumption, let me be a little more precise, a legal presumption that vaccines are safe and effective. They would not have been licensed by the FDA if they weren't safe and effective. They would not have been mandated by state legislatures if they were not safe and effective. Now, I don't personally believe that for a second. My point here is about legal status. And for purposes of writing a statement of religious beliefs, that's the wrong place to address the issue. I'm not saying that if you disagree with these legal presumptions, I'm positing that there's nothing we can do. It's about where you do it. We need to go back to the state legislatures and say, here's the information about vaccines you haven't seen or were misled about or didn't know or what have you, and get them to change the laws. And that will change the legal presumptions. But
in the middle of trying to exercise an exemption, it's not the time to try and reinvent the law.
Exactly. And it's not the time to try to argue with people who aren't going to be able to hear you anyway that there's a problem with vaccines. The place to take the problem with vaccines issue is the legislature is not in a vaccine religious exemption. And for the most part, I think not in the courts, but we'll have to see how some...
So it's very important before I try and exercise a religious exemption to understand what the boundaries, you know, are in that process within the state that I'm in. And it's very...
Find out what the procedure is in your state and clear, you know, make sure you're clear, first of all, that there is an option, a religious exemption option. But you need to see, you know, what the particular language of the law in your state is and what the procedure is. But as a general rule, in terms of the boundaries of what does and doesn't qualify, that's a federal First Amendment constitutional question. It's not an issue at the state level unless you're in one of the handful of states that have one of these laws where they still say you have to be a member of an organized religion. But those kinds of laws were challenged in at least 5 different states in state or federal court, and every time they were held to be unconstitutional. So the states that still have those kinds of laws, Oregon has one right now, South Carolina, there's probably a few others, those laws are pretty clearly unconstitutional because they've been held to be unconstitutional every time they've been challenged in the past. It's just that nobody's gotten around to challenging them in those in
every one of the states. Yeah. So let's. So within schools, we've talked about religious exemptions. What are the other exemptions that a parent could potentially exercise within a school context?
Well, medical exemptions are available everywhere. They're pretty difficult to qualify for. In some states, and this is true of medical and religious, this next point, in some states the state has authority to scrutinize the exemption, and in some states it doesn't. And it just depends on the specific wording in each state. So if you're in a state that can't challenge, scrutinize the exemption, but say for the medical, then if a doctor says, you know, I recommend this person or child not get the vaccine, then you're good to go, in terms of school exemptions anyway. But in many states, they can challenge the exemption. And let's face it, Catherine, everybody knows that a bureaucrat sitting in an office in the state capitol knows more about your child's health than your child's doctor. And obviously, I'm being facetious, but there are instances where a doctor recommends a child not get vaccinated, and the state says, no, we don't accept this doctor's opinion, and then the child has to get vaccinated anyway. And it's just... these kinds of things I find rather disturbing, but it does happen. So,
Alan, what do you do if, because I've heard the parents say this before, if the school tells you, well, there's no such thing as an exemption, you can't exercise an exemption, what do you do?
Sometimes one of the simplest and least expensive ways out is to call the health department and see if you can get them involved. I had a situation here in North Carolina once where a client calls me and a junior high school principal tried to tell the mother that she had to be a member of an organized religion, and we don't have one of those kind of laws here in North Carolina. We have a real simple 2-sentence law, paraphrased, says if you have a sincerely held religious belief, you are exempt. And the second sentence says, write a statement of your beliefs, and that takes the place of the certificate of immunization that you would otherwise have to provide for school enrollment. So the principal was completely out to lunch, and I was prepared to get in as an attorney and write a letter and charge my client, you know, an appropriate attorney fee. And I don't remember in this instance how it happened, but the health department got involved, and they called the school and explained it to the principal, and this woman saved some money in what would have been a more difficult battle, potentially, getting me involved. So a lot of times when people have questions or concerns, I say it might depend on exactly what the issue is, but you might be able to clarify them with the health department. Because if an attorney makes an argument, the people on the other side can just hire their attorney to make a counter-argument.
Right.
If the health department says, no, there's a right here and here's how it works, they're probably going to not try to contest that. But there are certain other kinds of issues where you really do just have to pull an attorney into it. Like I have, I've had situations where people, where private schools say or believe that the exemption doesn't apply to them. And the answer to that question also varies from state to state depending on the wording of the laws. But that's an example of an issue where an attorney can get involved and explain, you know, here's the law and the proper interpretation. Or sometimes schools, as do the vast majority of hospitals that I've worked with, they think you have to have a member of the clergy be involved or what have you, and most of the time that's not true according to the state laws for school exemptions. And when it does say that in the state law, it's arguably unenforceable because it's unconstitutional. So sometimes I've been able to work with people in those states and help them get the exemption even though they didn't qualify according to the word or letter of the law, because that part of the law is unconstitutional.
Okay, so let's turn to healthcare, because the reason you and I started talking again about doing the Saleri Report is because there's a real push now to get healthcare workers vaccinated and to adopt through the workplace much more aggressive vaccination policies. So maybe if you could bring us down on what's been going on in hospitals and healthcare, and what is happening, and how exemptions can help doctors, lawyers, doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers.
It's my understanding, and I heard this from a hospital attorney, and I haven't yet had time to track it down and pinpoint it in writing in the law. But it's my understanding that, or not all of this, but Medicaid and Medicare, CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, is, first of all, this part I am clear about, is requiring hospitals to report staff immunization rates as of this year, I believe. And my understanding is they're going to be withholding eventually up to 2% of Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement from hospitals that don't have a 90% vaccination rate. Now, this is everybody. I've heard, of course, from nurses and doctors and therapists, but I've heard also from a hospital cook and the guy who does data entry in a building down the street that isn't even, you know, in any way remotely connected or associated with patients directly. Everybody is being required to get the flu vaccine in hospital setting. And they seem to be, hospital administrators, particularly not interested or receptive to having a conversation about the merits of the policy itself. And I think that's in large part because their hands are tied. It's a money issue, and they're not going to, out of some sort of idealistic position about vaccines, give up part of their Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements. So I think that's a lot of what's driving it, at least my understanding at this point. But I worked with healthcare workers back in 2010 and 2011, but this past fall, the issue just exploded. I have never had so much work in my life, frankly. I ended up working with about 150 healthcare workers in 26 states last fall and early winter, and had, because of that, a very interesting and I think unique exposure and experience, sort of a cross-section of the nation, if you will, on what's going on in this issue. And there were three or four things that really stood out to me, Catherine. First of all, and this was disturbing to me, is the vast majority of hospitals that I've had exposure to through my clients have implemented exemption policies, and specifically with regard to religious exemptions, unlawful policies. The vast majority of them have a policy requiring you to have a letter from a member of the clergy or a member of the clergy to sign their form or some involvement and to validate that you're a member of an organized religion that has tenets opposed to immunizations. And that's just blatantly unconstitutional and in violation of federal civil rights law, the 1964 Federal Civil Rights Act, and the part of that called Title VII. It's Roman numeral 7. That deals with discrimination in the workplace. So I have been helping educate hospitals around the country about Title VII and the boundaries of the right to refuse vaccines for religious reasons in the workplace. This is an arena where, of course, they're coming from a position of doing anything and everything they can to maximize immunization rates, and if you, the employee, want to bother to go out and spend your time and money figuring out what your rights are and getting an attorney or whatever, then you can do that. But I am happy to say that it appears that many of these hospitals are changing, have been changing their policies. It's not clear in other instances whether they're just letting my client through and they're not going to change the policy for anyone else or not, although I suspect that's going on in some cases. But I've had, for the most part, broad agreement with hospital attorneys when they get involved, and the vast majority of my clients have been successful. The ones that are most difficult for me are ones who tried on their own first, get rejected, and then they come to me. Because almost everyone who does that has done the very first thing I tell my clients not to do when they come to me up front. So it is a classic example of one of those arenas where your beliefs are going to be scrutinized. They are going to look for a way to reject you. And many times I've had to write to hospital CEOs to try and get someone's attention. I've discovered that when you write to the CEOs, the information very quickly gets to the hospital attorney, and then things usually work out for the best.
But, we have a question from a subscriber asking about universities and whether or not vaccinations are required for admission or enrollment, and what you do in those circumstances.
Yeah, most, if not all states now, require some vaccines for college students, just like they do for grade school. And as far as I know, any time a state mandates vaccines at either the grade school level or college level, they'll usually have very similar, if not the same, exemption options and procedures in both arenas. The place that gets tricky, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is, and the exception to this, is with healthcare curriculums where the students have to do clinical work in local hospitals. What the schools do is contract with local hospitals to provide vaccinated students. And the schools will tell the students, well, the state exemption is fine for the classroom, but it's not for the hospital, because the hospital is requiring these, you know, as a contractual condition and as a policy matter. It's not a state required vaccine, and therefore the state law doesn't apply. That's probably correct. But it turns out that the federal civil rights law we were just talking about that applies to employees has language that covers students doing clinical rotations in local hospitals. The language has to do with not only employees, but uses the word apprenticeship or people in training. And that's clearly what's going on when a nursing student, for example, is doing clinical rotations in a hospital as part of her nursing school curriculum. So the civil rights law provides an out, but I have never found a school, in terms of my clients, a school or a hospital that knows about this law. And so it's a situation where students need two things. They need a legally sound statement of beliefs, but they invariably, in my experience, they'll also need a letter from an attorney to the appropriate school administrator or other persons explaining to them that, yes, you're correct, there's probably not a state law right here, but there is a federal law right for the students to refuse vaccines. So a lot of my work in this area, employees and healthcare curriculum students, is about educating schools and hospitals about the federal law.
One of the another question is it true that schools are compensated by, they said, government or big pharma for the number of students that they achieve vaccinations for? So is there, in essence, a financial kickback?
I have heard information about this. I don't have a specific example off the top of my head, but I recall in recent years having seen information about school vaccination rates being tied to state and or federal funds. So I can only respond to that generally, that it's my impression that that has occurred in at least some instances, but that's as precise of an answer as I could give right now.
I'll tell you, my impression from talking to parents and healthcare practitioners all over the country is they have far more power to exercise exemptions that they know. And there's a great effort to kind of not let people know this is available, and they feel somewhat cornered as though they have to go along. And I think the thing that most impresses me, and there are many things that impress me about your work and your practice, Ellen, but that most impresses me is you've really made an effort with your book and all your research and practice to really teach people about the power that they have under the law to protect themselves from vaccinations if they don't want to take them. And so I on behalf of all of us, I just want to say thank you and ask you again if you would walk through what's on your website, give us your URL and the name of your book, how to buy it. Just walk us through all the resources you make available so that those of us who are going to be in a position to need to exercise our exemptions can get a hold of this, and then explain whether or not and how you're available also to help.
I'd be delighted, Catherine. My primary website is vaccinerights.com, vaccinerights.com. I have a secondary website. It's linked on the homepage of vaccinerights.com, so you don't need to memorize the URL, but it's the Pandemic Response Project, and it's those three words, .com, pandemicresponseproject.com. But on the vaccinerights.com website, I have a lot of free information, introductory information about exemptions in all the main different categories I've mentioned. My ebook is there, and it's only available as an ebook. You can buy it online, or you can order it through the mail. Some people don't like to use a credit card over the internet, and so people can order it through the mail, and I'll give it them. It's still the electronic book, but on a disc. My goal with the ebook is called The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, and I saw a lot of conflicting information on the internet, and it's a sensitive comment here, and I just want to be really careful to state that I mean absolutely no disrespect for anyone, but I find that anti-vaccine websites, on the whole, not all, but on the whole, when they get into details about exemption and waiver rights and procedures, they end up with a mixture of accurate and inaccurate information, and I wanted to help clarify some of those points and to even take it deeper. And so that's why I wrote the ebook. The goal for the ebook is to give people the information they need to make informed vaccine exemption and waiver decisions, including such things as when do you need an attorney? You know, because sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. But it's sort of like I say to people, if you have to state your beliefs, that's a place to consider, especially if they can be scrutinized. That's a place to consider having an exemption, because if you put something together and put it out there and it has some sort of technical legal flaw to it, it's just really hard to unring that bell, really difficult to come back later.
Right. You're new at this and you're up against experts. So you better, yeah.
Depending on the situation. You know, some situations like some school exemptions, like I say, you just sign a form or check a box. You don't have to hire an attorney to figure out how to do that. You know, so... everybody doesn't need one, but anybody who wants to know more about the law in general, the ebook is a great resource for that. I had an instance recently, Catherine. I'll try to be real brief here because I'm going a little bit on a tangent, but it was such a mixed blessing. I got a call from somebody with ABC, and they put out an article nationally recently about some Indiana nurses who got fired, and I represented some of the nurses at that hospital. They made a statement in the article, though, that was really frustrating, and I'm sure it was accidental, but they were quoting me as having said that the law, this is the federal civil rights law for employees, that the law is so broad that it protects any sincerely held belief. And I specifically said, as I do to all my clients, to the reporter or the journalist in this article, that the law does not protect any sincerely held religious belief. It's really, really broad in terms of who can potentially qualify. So I've got this national attention, national mention. and yet was misquoted, and so that was sort of a mixed bag for me. But as we've mentioned, there are many, many different areas where exemption and waiver issues come up, and the most important, I think, single piece of advice I give people generally is that if you are doing a religious exemption and you have to state your beliefs, that's the place to consider, one way or another, getting information about what does and doesn't qualify, because it's not always consistent with most people's common sense approach. And it's a self-serving thing to say, and I'll just acknowledge that conflict of interest right up front, because there, as far as I know, there isn't anybody else in the country doing what I do to the extent that I do it. A lot of attorneys who, to one degree or another, have exemption work as maybe sort of a sideline, or who help nurses in this situation as part of larger employment law, for example, but nobody who really focuses on it the way that I do. But it's good to work with an attorney if you've got to state your beliefs, is sort of the general rule of thumb there. The Pandemic Response Project website is something that came out of my realization during the swine flu pandemic that most states have laws that if the state declares an emergency and mandates an emergency vaccine, your routine immunization exemptions go out the window. So historically, we've always had, wherever we've had a right in a state for a philosophical or religious exemption, it's always been a qualified right. It's always been there only up to the point that the state says, oops, never mind. And I think most people don't realize that about routine exemptions. It's not an absolute right. And this is something, it's a whole other story, won't take time to try to get into, but there was a Model State Emergency Health Powers Act that was put out right after 9/11, riding that wave of fear from 9/11 that was successful in changing laws in states around the country, passing overreaching laws, giving the state excessive authority. And one part of that was laws throwing exemptions out the window, routine exemptions in during emergency times. So when there's an emergency is declared, the legal landscape changes. And the goal of the Pandemic Response Project is to change emergency health laws, primarily at the state level, and then secondarily to support and promote informed choice generally. And that's primarily a legislative agenda. There's a wonderful website. It's associated with the National Vaccine Information Center, nonprofit organization. It's NVICAdvocacy.org, NVICAdvocacy.org. This is a website dedicated exclusively to vaccine legislative issues. You can go to the homepage and see a list of current pending bills that are either trying to add more vaccine requirements for kids in school or trying to pass exemptions. There have been several states, and there's a fast-growing trend that have either already passed laws or are trying now as we speak to pass laws restricting access to school exemptions, a wave over the last couple of years in particular. And many of them are, in my opinion, unconstitutional. These are unconstitutional restrictions. They're trying to combat what has been a slow but steadily rising exemption rates around the country as more and more people become aware of the vaccine issue and start looking for ways to opt out. So it's a real curious time, Catherine, because there is growing pressure on multiple levels to force and impose more vaccines at the same time that they're trying to restrict access to exemptions. And yet there's a growing awareness about the vaccine controversy and a growing number of people questioning vaccines and asking and looking for ways to opt out. I'm not sure how this is going to play out. It's very, very, very interesting because